So this is, can you hear me at the back clearly? This is the final seminar period, although we will have still time for discussion, and there'll be a concluding session this afternoon as well. I'd just like to step back a bit and acknowledge where I'm coming from. I consider myself a secular Buddhist. I'm not interested in, nor do I have much confidence in ideas such as past and future lives, laws of karma built into the unfolding of the world. I'm concerned with this world in the literal meaning of the word secular, seculum, meaning this age, this time, this place, this world. I'm also an atheist. I cannot make any sense of the idea of God. It is not meaningful for me. And yet, curiously, I am passionately concerned with what the Buddha taught. It's not the case that I feel that my interpretation of the Buddha's teaching is somehow the correct one. What I feel is very rich in the Buddhist tradition is precisely that it is able to give rise to so many different forms through its history. It is able to somehow remain coherent as Buddhism, and yet as it has gone to different countries in its history, it has spoken to people in those places in ways that has addressed and spoken to their needs. And every form of Buddhism that we know is based not on the entirety of all of the canonical materials, but has selected elements that speak to them. And the edifice of, let's say, Tibetan Buddhism or Zen Buddhism or Theravada Buddhism is built upon a selected number of passages from different canons. In other words, I feel that Buddhism has not yet exhausted its capacity to tell new stories about itself. And so I find this conflict within myself. I'm on the one hand intuitively drawn to the Buddha, his teaching, the Buddhist tradition, and yet at the same time I find myself almost repelled in some ways by certain aspects, certain features of that teaching as presented in the canon. So in other words, I find myself involved in a kind of passionate dialogue with this tradition as I struggle to make sense of it, as I'm recognizing through mindfulness, through meditation, through self-analysis, the limitations of my own understanding, the limitations of my own intelligence, and I recognize that many of the positions I take, I'm doing so on the basis of intuition, perhaps rather more than scholarly precision. And somehow I try to bring these various threads together in a way that provides me with a framework for living my life as fully and as totally as is possible in this world, as a response to the suffering of this world. not only my own suffering, but the suffering that we witness each time we open a newspaper or switch on the television or witness some crisis of sickness or aging or death in our immediate family, in our community. The touchstone, I feel very much, is the relationship we have to suffering, in that broader sense that I tried to sketch last night. Now, one of the images in the Buddhist text that I find perhaps the most useful in framing a thoroughly secular understanding of the Dhamma is in the Buddha's parable of the city, which is the passage that opens my handout. I'm going to read it, and then I'll make some comments on it, and then we'll go back to where we left off last night. Suppose, monks, a man wandering through a forest would see an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past, and he would follow it and would see an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, a delightful place. Then the man would inform the king or a minister, "Sire, know that while wandering through the forest I saw an ancient path. I followed it and saw an ancient city. Renovate that city, sire." Then the king or minister would renovate that city, and sometime later that city would become prosperous and successful, well populated, filled with people, attained to growth and expansion. So too, monks, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road, travelled by the Buddhas of the past. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road? It is just this noble eightfold path. There's a slightly different translation here. Appropriate seeing, thought, speech, action, livelihood, mindfulness, and concentration. Then I followed that path, and by doing so I have directly known aging and death, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation. In other words, the Four Noble Truths. Now, what is striking about this image is that the Buddha compares this ancient path that he has somehow stumbled across while walking in a forest. He compares that to the Eightfold Path. And where does this Eightfold Path lead? It leads to the equivalent, or what is symbolized by, the image of this ancient city. And the ancient city is here understood as the four noble or four ennobling truths. In other words, the Eightfold Path does not lead to Nibbana in this image. It does not lead to the cessation of birth and death, liberation from rebirth. It leads to a practice of knowing suffering, letting go of craving, experiencing cessation, and creating a path. And that path is again the Noble Eightfold Path, which leads to the Four Noble Truths: knowing suffering, letting go of craving, experience cessation, and entering the Noble Eightfold Path, which leads to And I could go on like this for the rest of the morning. I think you get the point. What this path leads to is a practice that itself incorporates the path that leads to etc. The Buddha's describing an ongoing process. He's not describing a process or a path that leads to a definite end. Now this model, this sequence, is actually mirrored in other places too, that the Eightfold Path leads to the Four Truths. If you look at the text we saw last night, the first sermon, the turning of the wheel, it's the same pattern. The Eightfold Path is what begins the text. The Buddha declares that he has found this middle way that avoids the two dead ends of indulgence and mortification. And again, what is a dead end? A dead end is something that actually doesn't take you anywhere. It's full of promise, like the advertising industry, but all it does is give you a brief satiation, and then you're back to wanting something else. It's a dead end. It's an anta. The word extreme, I think, doesn't quite catch that, and that's the usual translation. Anta, of course, is also tied into Mara. Mara is the antaka, the one who imposes dead ends, limits. The middle path is a way of life that keeps on opening up new vistas, new possibilities, new perspectives, as opposed to a life dedicated to sensory gratification or self-gratification, or on the other hand, a life dedicated to self-punishment. Both those just keep on going round and round and round and never really getting anywhere. So the Eightfold Path, which leads to the Four Truths, which entails the Eightfold Path, which leads to the Four Truths, this is a process of living that somehow is like a feedback loop. At each phase, we touch another depth. It's as though, as we know suffering, as that leads us to let go that little bit more of our grasping and craving, as that brings us to moments of stopping, of stillness, of freedom, that allows the entry into the path. In each turn of that process, we touch, or we are enabled to touch, a deeper insight into that process. The process is also holomorphic, in the sense that every little bit of the process somehow contains the whole. This is very clear in one of the definitions of the first step of the Eightfold Path, which is usually translated as right view. I'd say appropriate seeing or true vision. Difficult to find the right word. But that, when the Buddha is asked, what is right view? In one text he says, right view is to understand the Four Noble Truths. So you enter the path, and the first step in that entry is to see the whole process within that first step. Or if you look at Sammasati, appropriate recollection or right mindfulness. Again, the teaching on right mindfulness starts with your attention and recollection of the breath and the body and the feelings, but that then culminates once more in recollection of the Four Truths. So we keep coming back to this central idea of the Four Truths. So we're talking of a way of life, a way of living in this world that becomes a template, a blueprint for another kind of city, or the restoration of a city. It's worth reflecting on this. In what way is the practice of the four truths the basis for the restoration of a city? A city being, of course, something very much of this world. It's interesting also that in the definition of the two dead ends, indulgence and punishment, he describes both of them as gamma, which I've translated here as uncivilized. The word literally means village. In other words, there's a recognition that the Buddha's path is about leading us beyond the cycle of rural life, which is largely, at least in his time, about survival and sustenance and the cycle of the seasons with little time for anything else, to the life of a city in which, as we saw earlier, economic conditions in India had now made possible. And a city is a symbol and also a locus, a place for a civilization, a civitas, a place where a culture, a civilization can be born. And I feel in this regard, the Buddha's concern is to introduce in this world the framework for another kind of culture, another kind of civitas, of civilization. One that engages every aspect of our human life. And the Eightfold Path, I think, really is just a sketch of all human activity. It's not just about meditation. It's about the way we see the world, the way we see ourselves. Particularly his very acute analysis of the nature of self itself. A self that is not some fixed thing that is quasi-eternal and perhaps in some level divine, but rather self as something which we create through our actions. The Buddha does not deny the existence of self. He recognizes that the self is a project that each person is free to realize. There's some passages later on in here you can see examples of that. It also has to do with the way we think, the way we reflect, the way we analyze, the way we work out problems in our mind, the way we make sense of things. It has to do with the way we communicate through speech. It has to do with the way we act in the world with our bodies, how we impact upon others, on the environment, on the world. It has to do with how we work, how we earn our livelihood, how we utilize resources in order to support ourselves, our community, our families. And that provides a sort of philosophical, ethical foundation for how we can then apply ourselves to what really matters, the deeper questions of life. And this brings us into the domain of recollection, of mindfulness, of concentration. In other words, those explicitly spiritual qualities, which are not floating free in some detached realm, but are embedded in our moral life, in the life of our thought and our vision. It's all an integrated whole, and that's why in this version I've translated Sama as integral. In fact, the word sama means something like whole or complete, an integer, integral, something complete. It's about a complete way of living fully in this world. Mara, or craving, or grasping, are problematic because they inhibit us from living fully. They restrict us, they confine us, they lock us into narrow perspectives, narrow views, normally about an obsession with my immediate gratification and safety. Whereas the Buddha, the Eightfold Path, are an opening out into a much wider vista that incorporates not only what we are, but what we and others can be. And it's that process, as exemplified through the practice of the Four Truths themselves, that leads to another way of being together in this world. The foundation, the seed bed of another kind of culture. And that for me is what inspires me about the Buddha's work. And of course, to some extent, this has succeeded. In other extents, it has failed. And each time Buddhism enters into a new context, it starts this experiment again. And I think what is happening now, not just in the so-called West, but really in Buddhism's encounter with modernity as such, it is faced with a new set of challenges. One of which is to articulate itself coherently in such a way that it addresses the suffering of the world as it is now. It addresses the needs and the longings and the aspirations of people who live and are informed in their views by the values and the visions of modernity and science and so on. Modernity, the modern world, modernity. It's actually a fairly complicated concept. Some would argue that we are now in a period of post-modernity. But I don't want to get into that here. So I think that sort of account enables us to look at these four truths from another perspective. Some of you have no doubt noticed that in my translation I dropped the whole idea of calling the truths the noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, the noble truth of the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. I feel that way of describing the truths very much locates them within the framework of achieving liberation from the cycle of birth and death. In other words, the classical Indian paradigm of what the ascetic tradition particularly sees as the ultimate goal of our existence. And that perspective, I have to admit, runs deeply through the early Buddhist tradition. It even runs deeply through the Mahayana tradition. So what I'm suggesting is a rather radical departure from one of the primary dogmas of Buddhist tradition. The idea that craving is the origin of suffering and the aim of the path is the ending of suffering. If we think, or as I am only concerned with, the practice of the Dharma in this world, the ending of suffering is only really meaningful in terms of the ending of rebirth. The Buddha describes suffering not just as some mental discomfort, but as birth, sickness, aging, death, the five aggregates. In traditional Buddhism of whatever school, the ending of suffering is not something that you'll get in this life. You might achieve a high degree of detachment, of insight, of inner peace, but as long as you are in a body, you're going to suffer. And there's no way around that. The only genuine ending of suffering is to remove what is believed to cause the whole cycle of birth and death, namely craving, so that you are not born anymore. Or as the Buddha says sometimes, you will no longer lie in a womb. That this is my last birth, as he says again and again. In other words, it's about cutting off life as we know it. I'm not interested in that. That doesn't mean anything to me. I'm concerned as to how to live this life to the full. And my sense is that particularly the latter part of the first sermon, that's what I was looking at last night, that the Buddha's awakening was to the four truths in those 12 aspects: fully knowing suffering, letting go of craving, experiencing cessation, and cultivating a path. That model is one that speaks far more to our condition here and now, as something to do. And it leads not to the end of suffering, which is actually weirdly the third truth, but to the path itself. The problem with craving, as I understand it, is not that it is the cause of suffering. I mean, obviously, to some extent it is. That's undeniable. But that it blocks us from engaging our lives fully by living according to the template, the values of the path itself. Craving is what prevents us from living fully. It's the great obstacle. It is, as I quoted last night, the presence of Mara in our lives. And Mara is that which limits and confines and constrains us to our little pocket of self-indulgence. It's also curious that when in the first sermon the Buddha declares quite explicitly that his awakening has to do with fully knowing suffering, letting go of craving, experiencing cessation, and creating a path, you will be hard-pressed to find any development of those particular terms and ideas in the canon. It's quite odd. It's quite rare to find that phrase, though these phrases repeated. They do occur here and there, but they certainly haven't been developed to the extent to which the idea that craving is the cause of suffering and the aim is the ending of suffering have been developed. It's as though it's been somehow ignored in an odd way. The other beauty I find of these four tasks, the four truths as four tasks, is that it provides us with a key to why the Buddha presented the four truths in the sequence he did. Suffering, or traditionally suffering, its cause, the end of suffering, and the path that leads to that. It's a rather curious sequence. You start with an effect, and then its cause, and then an effect, and then its cause. If you look at the four truths in terms of these four tasks, you can see quite clearly, I think, how one, the first truth is the condition for the second truth is the condition for the third truth is the condition for the fourth truth. you get the sequence, and you also get a very good example of the idea of conditioned arising, of dependent origination. When this is, that comes to be. When you fully know suffering, the letting go of craving comes to be. When you let go of craving, the experiencing of its cessation comes to be. When the experience of the cessation of craving comes to be, the Eightfold Path arises. And you can see, I think, in a very economical and in a rather beautiful way, how the Four Truths are describing a sequence of actions, one which leads to the next. But not in a final and absolute sense. Because once you get to the Eightfold Path, that's not the end, but it's another beginning. It too leads to mindfulness, to concentration. But what are you mindful about? What do you concentrate on? And here I feel you come back to the first truth. You are mindful of suffering. You focus on the reality of suffering. And then you continue again. There's something endless about this. There may well be, in this process, moments of deep insight and illumination. One may further this process by practices that lead you into deep states of mental absorption and focus. But that is not the end or the main purpose of the process. That is simply one element within a greater way of life. And it's continuous, it's ongoing. It's happening right now, and as far as I can see, it'll keep on being a practice that will last until the end of my life. And I may never get to some final end, and I'm not interested in that anymore. I'm interested in living in this world in which I am more and more attuned and open to the presence of suffering, and through doing which my perspective on how to lead my life is transformed. Let's just look a little bit more closely about how the first truth of fully knowing suffering leads to a falling away or a letting go of craving. If we were to imagine that we experienced ourselves and the world in the sort of way I sketched last night, where we fully understand that we have been born, that we will grow old, that we will fall sick, and that in the end, whether in 20 years' time or next week, we will die. That is the starting point. And that's very clear from the text itself. Birth, sickness, aging, death. If we come to experience our lives in a felt and real way, where those things, our existence, in other words, become something that we are fully conscious of, that we sense and feel almost in our bones, that this great question of life and death, as the Chinese called it, is really what matters most fundamentally to us. When that becomes the primary concern, the primary focus of our lives, there's less and less room for a life that is dedicated to getting this, getting rid of that, or as the Buddha says, craving is repetitive. It wallows in attachment and greed, obsessively indulging in this and that, craving for stimulation, craving for existence, craving for non-existence. Such a mode of behavior is only really going to have a basis if we see the world as essentially a realm of things and persons that we can possess, that we can own, that we can manipulate, that we can get rid of, that we can be gratified by, that we can achieve some status through getting to know someone. All of those strategies that somehow are forgetting or ignoring the great question of life and death. You may be the most wealthy, the most famous, the most intelligent person on earth, and you might take great pride and conceit in that, and yet it will all come to nothing should you have a stroke or a heart attack, or should a bomb land on your house. That these things, for whatever value they have, are somehow always relatively superficial. That they don't really concern that deeper sense of what it is to be in this world, this existential awakening to birth and sickness and aging and death. And if we could see the whole of our lives from the perspective of our mortality, from the perspective of our fragility and our vulnerability, that would change everything. We would stop grasping and craving, not because we somehow made a strong choice to do so, but simply because it would make less and less sense. It just wouldn't happen anymore. I found this, for example, when I'm in the presence of sickness, or in the presence of death, say at a funeral, suddenly everything changes. You see your life from another point of view. I was recently asked to go and see a friend of my brother's, who's a woman of 40 years old, with two beautiful young kids, and yet she's been diagnosed with motor neuron disease. Her body and her nervous system is wasting away, and she has less than a year to live. It's a terribly tragic situation. Her husband likewise has distanced himself from her. The kids are aware that mummy is going to die, but of course they don't really understand that. And when you're in the presence of a person like that, someone who is sensitive, who has found through doing meditation and studying Buddhist philosophy an enormous help in coping with this situation, all your trivial worries and concerns and what do people think about me, it all is irrelevant. Likewise, at funerals, at death, everybody, irrespective of their beliefs or whether they're religious or not, is suddenly confronted with something much more profound. Of course, we socialize it and ritualize it so that we can get through it. But deep down, we know that we're touching something here that is so infinitely more real, more precious, more true than so many of the things that we spend our lives being preoccupied about. So letting go of craving is not something that you choose to do, although if you do choose to do, that's obviously a good idea. But if you don't have the foundations of another perspective on life, it'll be like fighting an uphill battle. You often find, for example, on a meditation retreat that you're sitting in meditation and you're terribly bothered by some anxiety or some worry or something in your life that you can't shake off. It might seem to be relatively trivial, but it's somehow got hold of you. And each time you sit and you watch your breath, the next thing you know, you're running that little loop tape that story just won't go away. And so you go to the teacher, most of whom are endlessly wise and compassionate, and you tell them about this, and they will very wisely and compassionately say, well, just let go. Which is good advice. But unfortunately, it doesn't always come with an instruction, how do I let go? What do I do? Just be mindful of it. That helps, definitely. Don't sort of identify with it. That's very helpful. But I don't feel that those sorts of instructions are really getting to the root of the problem. The root of the problem lies much deeper. It lies with our whole view of the world. It lies with our whole almost instinctive perspective on life as something I can achieve this, I can get that, I can get rid of that. The transformation that the Buddha is asking of us is a very profound one, and it is very difficult, because it seems that not only our culture but our whole neurobiological organism is pushing the other way. And this is what the Buddha meant, as I said yesterday, that his Dhamma goes against the stream. It goes against the flood of instinctive habits. It goes against so much of what our culture tells us. It goes against what our parents probably told us. It is a struggle. It's like, if you imagine when you're swimming down a river, it's very easy because the current takes you with it. You can make a few nice strokes and you see the banks go by. It's fun. But if you decide to turn round and swim upriver, you have to make a lot more effort, and sometimes, even when you're making a lot of effort, you're still going backwards. Have you had that experience in a little boat, perhaps? It's very frustrating. You make negative progress. And not only that, but it's also terribly uncomfortable because all of the other stuff in the river is being thrown in your face. The water's lapping against you, bits of flotsam and jetsam are bumping into you. It's hard work, you get really tired. And I feel in many ways the practice of the Dhamma is hard work. Sometimes people think coming on a meditation retreat is all about chilling out, getting a bit blissed. I've never really found that. I found it's actually more like a struggle, in a way. It's hard work. My Tibetan teacher, Geshe Rabdin, he used to say, he says, you go into a room full of people meditating, and they all look terribly peaceful, very quiet, very serene. But if you could look into their minds, it would be like a boxing match, was the image he used. Of course, there are periods in our practice when it is smooth. It does go well, and that's very, very important, very reassuring, very confirming of what one is doing. But we probably know that those things are moments of grace, perhaps. Moments of where the storm has died down a bit. But we come back to sit at the next session, and we're back into the boxing arena again. That same struggle, that anxiety, those uncertainties, those unresolved emotions and feelings and worries, and it's all pouring forth. That's life. And that's what the Buddha is saying. Know that. Fully know that. Open your eyes to that. Don't flinch away from it. Don't hesitate. Don't turn the other way. And of course, this knowing of suffering may start with our own encounter with our own lives. But as we look into our own lives, especially when we pay attention to impermanence, that it's changing, to dukkha, that it is somehow shot through with the possibility of the tragic, and anatta, the fact that in the midst of all of this thought and feeling and physical sensation, there is no fixed point, no controller. The Atman, the self, the Buddha is critiquing, is the idea that there is someone in charge, or there's something in charge, there's some kind of directing agent. Now, when you look at yourself, when you experience yourself, you begin to realize more and more that there isn't. As the Buddha said in the second sermon, also given in the Deer Park shortly after the first, he said, if the body were self, then you would never get sick, because you could tell the body, be well, or don't get sick. It sounds funny, but that's oddly how we feel about ourselves sometimes, that we're kind of in charge. There's something standing behind everything, pulling the strings. It's just a matter of getting it right. But when we begin to recognize that this cell of me, in fact, doesn't really exist in any real way as a thing in my body, my mind, my feelings, my emotions, nor does it exist separately from any of that, the whole obsession with one's ego and one's own self-importance likewise begins to erode and fade. It becomes less of a compulsive attitude. It wears away. And in the wearing away of self-preoccupation, it's not just that we come to some higher understanding, but it has an affective transformation as well. We become more sensitized, more open, more transparent to the suffering of others. It's very easy to empathize with people who you consider to be my people, me and mine. Everyone can be terribly loving towards their children, their friends, their fellow members of the Communist Party, or whatever it might be. But as soon as a person does not belong to that sphere of mine, then you can very easily be heartless. And unfortunately, our history has shown this to us only too well. The fully knowing suffering is also fully knowing our common humanity. Suffering is the great leveler. There are no borders or boundaries in suffering. There is no man or woman. There is no black or white person. There is no Jew or Arab. There is no gay or straight. There are no borders in dukkha. Dukkha is an open country which you cannot segregate one group from another. It's what unites us. So to fully know dukkha is also to open ourselves to the common fate of all sentient beings. There's also no human and animal. Birds and insects and dogs and cats and tigers and lions are likewise born, they get sick, they get old, they die. Buddhism is, in that sense, not a humanism. It's a sentient beingism. It's open to the fate and the life and the pain of all living creatures. Sabbasatta, all beings. So the practice of fully knowing dukkha is not just about experiencing one's own and thereby perhaps letting go or dropping off certain negative habits of craving, but it is also the opening to empathy, the capacity to feel not just my own suffering, but the suffering of the other. And that is the foundation, the indispensable foundation for love and compassion. Compassion, technically in Buddhism, being the longing that the other does not suffer. And metta, or love, loving kindness, the longing that the other be happy. And I think that's only genuinely possible when you have fully embraced the commonality of suffering that we all share. There is no difference between my birth, sickness, aging and death and your birth, sickness, aging and death. That's what unites us. That's what allows us to be able to feel the other's pain, to be inside the other person's skin, to empathize, to feel in the other, or compassion, to feel with. In German, they have this beautiful word, Mitleid, to suffer with is compassion. Mitleid, Mitgefühl, to feel with the other. So compassion and love are not the outcome of Buddhist practice, they are the foundation of Buddhist practice. They are implicit in the First Noble Truth itself. And so the letting go of craving is not just ceasing to crave chocolate bars and BMW cars and Toshiba laptops. It's also ceasing to crave something special, something for my people as opposed to your people, for this class of people as opposed to that, for humans rather than animals, or trees or plants. It's a falling away of these deeply seated habits that will keep on coming back. It's quite clear from how the Buddha describes this process that just because you've entered the path, you've had an experience of stopping, moments in which that craving, that grasping, that selfishness momentarily at least fall away. And that is the experience of Nibbana. And you can see how, or Nirvana. So the fully knowing suffering leads quite naturally to a falling away, a letting go of certain graspings and cravings and so on. And that letting go or falling away of craving is the condition under which that craving can stop. And that's what the end of suffering means, even in the classical version. When the Buddha describes the Third Noble Truth, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, he says the cessation of suffering is the cessation of craving. And that, I think, is an oddity in the formulation, in a way. He doesn't describe the ending of suffering as not taking birth anymore, but he says it's the ending of craving. So I would argue from this perspective that the aim of the practice of Dhamma is not the ending of suffering, it's the ending of craving. It's the ending of that way of life that is premised on greed, on hatred, on fear, on delusion. And by experiencing moments in our lives, whether in meditation, whether in the course of our daily affairs, moments when we find ourselves miraculously freed from those habitual impulses and drives, when we experience a radical openness to the other, when we experience a possibility of responding to the other's pain out of empathetic identity rather than out of, oh, I should be kind to that person because I'm a Buddhist, or I should be kind to that person because it wouldn't look good if I wasn't, or whatever other kind of rationale, when one's response is spontaneously empathetic, that is what the experience of cessation of craving allows. And it's that stopping, which technically is described as a stopping of self-preoccupation, a loss also of doubt. You now know for yourself that that's possible. It's a falling away also of the idea that spiritual or religious practice has to do with observation of rites and rituals. That opens up the possibility of another way of life, and that way of life is the Eightfold Path. And that's what it means to enter the stream. There's a very good, if you're interested, you should read the Sotapatti Samyutta, the Connected Discourses on Stream Entry. And this is what the Buddha says. He says, the stream. Now what now, Sariputta, is the stream? And Sariputta says, the stream is the Noble Eightfold Path. The stream is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Buddha says, yes, Sariputta, well said. The stream is the Noble Eightfold Path. In other words, it's that whole way of life. It's not that you've now entered into some sort of mystical experience that you're going to have. No, the stream is the Eightfold Path. And the other way the Buddha describes the stream or stream entry is, and this is in the Sotapatthi Samyutta, this is the primary way he expresses it. He says the person who enters the stream is one who has firm confidence in the Buddha, firm confidence in the Dhamma, and firm confidence in the Sangha, and is committed to the virtues that lead to concentration. Or sometimes he says, the virtues which are praised by the noble ones. So stream entry is not some private mystical moment, but actually it is a total metanoia, a total turning around of the priorities of your life, a centering your life on another core set of values, the awakening and the insight that's embodied in the figure of the Buddha, but primarily, and this is the only real refuge, is the practice of the Dhamma itself. Of course, this is also something we don't do in isolation, but that practice is supported by friendships and by community with those who share similar aspirations, the Sangha. So it's a much larger picture of what stream entry means than what is sometimes thought of as a sort of private insight gained at a certain moment in your practice. That's part of it. But the bigger picture is about a fundamental reorientation of your values, a fundamental reorientation of the direction of your life. And that is summarized in this Eightfold Path, which, as we've seen, leads again to the Four Truths, round and round, not in a circle, but more in a spiral of development and evolution, of increasing depth, increasing openness, in which every moment of life becomes an opportunity or a challenge to live that perspective more fully and more totally. And that, I think, is perhaps a good place to stop. So we'll now have a period of walking meditation, followed by another sitting, and then we'll have quite a long discussion before lunch. And then at lunch, we've decided that silence will end. No. You don't want that?
Yes.
Yes? No? You want to vote on it? apparently the tradition is that you don't speak during the last lunch. Is that correct? You prefer that? Okay, we'll break silence after lunch or at the Dana talk.
We can have what sometimes people do is just divide the room, and if people want to
okay.
Sit in one place,
it never works.
It never works, I'm told. That's the best. Let's do that. Let's try and divide the room. So can you just arrange that some tables will have silence and others won't? Thank you.